The neighborhood emergency teams are these teams of neighbors that are trained and meet regularly and practice to give assistance to their neighbors during a disaster. And our bureau provides that training, and we do criminal background checks. We help them secure resources for their teams, and we are in really very regular communication with them.
So how would I find out if my neighborhood does have a team?
I would invite you to visit our website at portlandoregon.gov.
So there is a list.
There is, yes.
Okay.
Carmen, if one of the concerns we have in a major event is vulnerable population, so older adults and people with disabilities, making sure that that would be a subset of which of these?
A couple of them, starting with our neighborhood emergency team. So I want to say that even though the number of neighborhoods has gone down, we actually lost a team, and we do have requirements for what constitutes a team. You have to have at least 5 members. They have to go through training. They have to maintain certain credentials. That the overall number of citizens that we've trained has gone up considerably. And one of the things that we do ask our NET teams to do is to go around door to door and check on those most vulnerable. So in the case of the boiled water, we had people going door to door and remind people not to drink the water without boiling during a snow and ice event. We have folks helping to shovel walkways and get food delivered. So it speaks to that one, and certainly it speaks to the number of people that have at least 1 week's worth of supplies in hand.
That actually sounds like something we could get data on that's responsive to Commissioner Fish's question. Like, we could correlate the neighborhoods with NET teams with neighborhoods with concentrations of seniors or other vulnerable people.
Well, we're going to get a presentation also tomorrow on age-friendly cities. We've got the data on the growing and graying population, and we also have a working understanding of some of the barriers, and particularly older adults reluctant to give their information to the government. Correctly picking up on a message that the Attorney General and others are giving them about not giving your information to strangers, but inhibiting our ability to link them so that in the event of an emergency, we can give them service. I have a philosophical question I want to put to Andrew. We're going to spend an hour having this extremely thoughtful conversation about these benchmarks. And we're all going to sort of walk away feeling like we understand it. But I'm afraid that the takeaway from someone that just looks at the headline is going to be parks in pretty good shape, homelessness a problem, and God help us if there's an emergency because we're down at zero. And this goes to the whole question of setting expectations off this data. And it grieves me knowing that emergency preparedness is a priority of the mayors and the commissioner in charge, knowing that we have a high-functioning bureau that does amazing work during emergencies. Why are we going to have a chart that shows we're at zero relative to other bureaus? And how do we avoid what I would consider a self-inflicted wound of giving the public potentially a misleading impression of our preparedness?
So I think it's important, and we've done it today, and we'll do it in terms of materials that are on the web, that we provide the context and explanation for this. I also think we can't prevent misreporting of data, and you know that comes up in other formats as well. I think it's important that the data that council's using is the most accurate and most relevant. We've had a good conversation. We can make some adjustments on that, and that we do. And I'll do my job, you know, on this in terms of talking to reporters and the public about the data. To the extent someone misinterprets it and says, "Well, that's a zero. The city's failing," which would be a misinterpretation. I'm not sure we can ever overcome that, but I wouldn't want to set lower targets or to change to benchmarks that are all going to be green so that we can avoid that. I think that getting the most relevant benchmarks, I mean, I think what this says is that the focus on emergency management is important and needed. And as we transition to a budget and bump conversation, I think hopefully this can filter into that. So what are the things we can do to move this so that we can start hitting some of these KPIs?
So I'm not suggesting we lower the bar. Mm-hmm. I think Senator Moynihan had a term for that. It was called defining deviancy down. Mm-hmm. It's whenever the government felt like they didn't have the will or the resources to address a problem, they just set the bar lower and declared victory. I'm not saying we do that. But if I didn't know anything about this process other than the word zero, emergency management, I might leave this meeting feeling, gosh, we're a little exposed. In fact, that's not the case at all. We have robust systems in place. It is simply this exercise and aspirationally moving forward But I don't know that that's a nuance that's going to be easy for, maybe you have more success than the rest of us briefing the press on these matters. I have a feeling it's going to be a harder message to get across.
Well, let me steal a little bit of the Bureau's talking points here, because I think, one, I want to reiterate or reinforce what Andrew said. This is a management tool. We should use it like a management tool and then figure out how to explain it to people rather than make it a PR tool and figure out how to manage with it. So we all get that. Secondly, unlike some of these other indicators, this is one where if a citizen says, oh, my God, we're only at zero, well, you know, isn't that terrible? This is one in which you can say, "And that, yes, that is a problem, and there's actually something that you can personally do about this one. You could start a net team in your neighborhood if you're one of the majority of neighborhoods that doesn't have one, and you could get yourself ready in your own home for an emergency. So please do that and ask your neighbors to do the same, and if enough people do that, then the number will move. You know, the government has to solve the rest of these problems pretty much by ourselves or with our governmental and nonprofit partners. In this case, there's actually something an individual citizen can do, and I think that's probably the best single thing we can use this alarming number for.
And I just want to go on record. I'm not suggesting we use it as a PR tool, and I'm not suggesting we compromise the standards, but I do think we're going to have some explaining to do, and I think the natural instinct is going to just look at bureau by bureau, looking at relative terms, and then a goose egg is a goose egg, and I think it does, it potentially sends a misleading impression to people who will be reading it. So.
I just want to interject in something about one performance indicator that I'd like us to gather the data for and start tracking, even though maybe it doesn't appear in the city's overall key performance indicators. Commissioner Fish is talking about vulnerable populations. Among the most vulnerable people we have are people who live or work in unreinforced masonry buildings. So what I'd like to have is gather the data on how many people live and work in those buildings now and set a target of reducing that number, which is something we're actually planning to do something about by adopting some sort of regulatory structure combined with some incentives.
So I'm going to wrap this section up so we can move on. And Carla, I don't know if we can get the slides back up, the last two in performance management. And thank you again to the bureaus. We've actually had they've put in a ton of work, and we've had some really great conversations. And they've been great three pilot bureaus. As we go to sort of where we're headed next, you want to go to the next slide there, Ryan. So again, just as a recap, this last year's process, we took the mayor's, you know, three priorities in terms of a starting point. We wanted to do a narrow focus in this first year. We took the mayor's three priorities, worked on some draft outcome measures last spring, finalized at the end of June. Now we've collected first quarter data, and this is, again, the first time you're reporting this. What we want to do in this year coming up is scale this up to involve all 26 bureaus in the city. And really having them, you know, all those bureaus have missions and strategic directions, and have those bureaus identify what their key performance measures are that are aligned with their bureau mission and strategic direction. Again, we're tracking 546 measures in the budget system and budget process, and bureaus are probably tracking a lot more that don't even get into that system. So my hope is that this is not a ton of new work. It's really saying, okay, what are the key performance measures that we're already doing that work on? And to the extent a bureau doesn't have those, we can spend some time, lend our expertise, talk to some outside folks as well about developing those measures, and again, to sort of do that for all 26 bureaus. And then the goal is going to be to bring that back, to do that work relatively quickly, and then bring that back in terms of next spring when you're having budget hearings and trying to have dashboards for each one of the bureaus. And again, those dashboards will also be works in progress. It'll be the first time that a lot of these, you know, we've put that data in that format. So that'll be an iterative process as we sort of develop that and get your feedback. But again, the hope is as we go through the 15-16 budget process, having more conversation. So again, those key takeaways, again, of this entire project and changing from performance measurement to a performance management system is to provide that information that's useful for decision-making, increasing focus on performance management. We're asking bureaus, when they submit decision packages, they're going to need to talk about the performance measures that it will impact and how it will impact those measures. CBO and our analyses, we're going to be asking those questions and, again, ranking projects and making recommendations based on performance metrics. And then we're hoping that council has that conversation as well in the work sessions and otherwise as we go through the process. Any questions overall on where we're headed? Anything I missed? Great.
And I appreciate the good work on this. This is a work in progress, but it's really useful. Again, just like the data that Josh presented earlier, the more we do this year after year, I think the more value we'll see from it.
Great. So we're going to power through. I think we can catch up in this next section there, and then take a short break before going into the fall bump. But right now we're going to talk about the city budget outlook, the preliminary city budget outlook for 15-16, and the budget guidance that the mayor issued a couple of weeks ago. So I'm going to bring Josh back up to the table. Thank you. To start through that. And again, this will be a little bit of a preview of the forecast, which is going to be out in December. But in terms of where we are.
Let's see. Okay, thanks, Andrew. Before we get going too far, I'd like to knock out a quick question. Commissioner Fritz, we rank 27th of 50 in foreign-born population, percentage of foreign-born population. The metro area is a little higher. It's about 22nd. So I thought we could knock that out before we get going here. Okay, so this is going to look more at Portland internally as we go through this. We've got yet another slideshow for you. Talk first really quick about the current economic conditions. I think the reality is the last 12 to 18 months have looked much more like a typical economic recovery. It should be under the city budget tab in your, it should be right after the performance management tab in your binders there. So it's looked a little bit more like a typical recovery. We are seeing above average employment growth in the area. In Portland, I'll show you in the next graph. In Portland, we've surpassed our pre-recession peak already, unlike pretty much the whole rest of the state. Our unemployment rate is even with the national average, a little bit better than the state. Home prices are rising still, but not as much as they were about a year ago, and that's actually a good thing. We know what it's like to have home prices rise by 15% for several years in a row and what typically follows something like that. Instead of seeing the 12, 15% growth we saw a year ago, we're seeing more sustainable 5, 6, 7% growth, at least in the near term. So that's encouraging in a good way. Vacancy rates, as Tracy mentioned, particularly in the rental markets, but also in office and industrial space, are very low in the city. This is the good time, as it were. If we move to the next slide, just looking at sort of Portland relative to the rest of the state. Portland is the only part of the state that's surpassed its pre-recession peak in employment. And we're one of, I believe, 12 cities, but don't quote me on that, out of those 50 that have done the same. So we've, and this is not atypical of Portland. We tend to have lower lows and higher highs. This happens to be a high, so we tend to be growing faster.
Josh, the Oregonian about 10 days ago had a story in the business section that said Portland has exceeded Washington County in per capita income and job growth. Why?
Well, it's a big question. Certainly there are sectoral developments. So our software industry here has certainly been a bright spot over the last several years. What's changing about that, and speaks a little bit to the import of highly educated folks, is that Portland used to be, anecdotally, a great place to start a high-tech company, start a software company, but you reach critical mass and you couldn't find the people to grow it or the venture capital. That appears to be changing with some very high profile components with Puppet Labs and Elemental Technologies and the like. Lattice Semiconductor is moving all of their executives and administrative folks to Big Pink down the street from Hillsboro. So there's, and part of that is because one of their executives lives in the Pearl. So it speaks to a variety of issues that drive sort of what you're describing. It's the livability, it's the desirability of Portland and the neighborhoods. We already know that large numbers of Nike and Intel employees live in Portland, even though their jobs may be out in Hillsboro and Beaverton. So I think there is a very distinct component to the livability of the city and its neighborhoods that's desirable for those folks.
Josh, could you please run this table again and split out Portland versus the metro area? Because I'd like to see illustrated, sure, what Commissioner Fish just said, and I think we have had over the course of the last 5 years ongoing information that Portland has done better than the rest of the metro area in these criteria. So I'd like to see that.
Yeah, we can absolutely do that. And I think you'll see an even more stark distinction than what Commissioner Fish was talking about with Portland and Washington County. The reality is Clackamas County, other parts of the metro area have not done as well, clearly, as Portland has.
So please do it on this same chart, because I think it's also important to show it against Oregon, against the other non-metro and cities. I'm really proud of what we've done over the course of the recession and climbing out of it. Of course, we have more to do, but it's good to see this chart.
Sure. And one quick caveat, because I will do it. It'll be Multnomah County employment data. The employment data, the way it runs on a countywide basis because it's based on unemployment insurance. But it'll we're 80% of the county, so it'll give you the same picture. As we flip the page, getting to something Tracy mentioned, multifamily housing permits. It doesn't take much of a drive to see all the building that's going on, especially on the Inner East Side, for multifamily permits. This is of note. You can see the cyclical nature of this, very much so. The drop-off between 2000 and 2009, we lost 96% of our multifamily activity in a year. However, that has rebounded rapidly, and we would expect over the next 10, 15, 20 years, multifamily will have a larger share because of demographics and because of a variety of issues, will have a larger share of the building in Portland. But this, you can see, we've already exceeded the bubble heights of multifamily permitting.
I just want to say this confirms the wisdom of the mayor assigning Parks to Commissioner Fritz. My first year as Parks Commissioner was 2009. You saw there were almost no building permits. Her first full year in 2014, historic highs. It just, I don't know if there's a cause and effect, but I'll also note that, because I want to pick up one of my credits here, the bulk of the money from that column she's actually spending in East Portland.
So as we move to slide five, I guess I have to challenge myself to my explanatory powers with one slide in every presentation. So bear with me for 1 second. This compares sort of parts of Portland that were influenced by the housing bubble disproportionately with places that have seen higher sales activity more recently. So if we look sort of vertically on the vertical axis, we're looking at places above the horizontal line had a larger share of their housing stock turnover during the housing bubble. So generally speaking, that means largely more speculative activity, more transient activity in terms of flipping and those kinds of things. Places below the line had less of that. So think about that in terms of how we look at it. The horizontal axis, so things to the left of center, are places that have benefited less from turnover in the near term. So places where housing prices probably haven't jumped as much. Places to the right of that axis have seen generally large price increases during the recovery. So the ideal place to be, generally speaking, is in that bottom right quadrant. And you'll see places like Hollywood, Rose City, Sellwood, Hillsdale. These are places that have seen some pretty significant value growth.
And Josh, just to explain again why that's the ideal place you had.
Because you probably had less speculative investment and less speculative purchasing during the housing bubble. But you've also seen more demand during the more recent time frame. So you're seeing more demand in your area, housing values rise. Places just above in the upper right-hand quadrant are places that tended to be less expensive during the housing bubble. So there was more investment opportunities. So they got influenced by the housing bubble. But there are also areas that are generally in up-and-coming neighborhoods, desirable places to live. You see more turnover there. So while they were susceptible to housing bubble problems, they're also reaping gains now from the current housing market.
Josh, the conventional wisdom is there were also more foreclosures in that top right-hand box, in part because of the predatory lending practices that we saw mapped in East Portland. So what's is there a correlation here?
I guess I would say that's true to some extent. Really where you're seeing, where I think if you mapped it, sort of the lingering effects, they're actually in the upper left-hand quadrant of a lot of those foreclosure activities. And we can see that in our, I'll get to it in just a second, we can see that in our property tax data. We don't have this year's data yet, but I think I know what it's going to tell us. And so this is just sort of an idea of sort of trying to parse out. This is something that I've been working on with some colleagues in Salem, just trying to get at some more micro-level data. It's basically by zip code. So there's different things we can do with the data. This was just sort of a way of looking at sort of the influence of the housing bubble and, the predatory components of that and all the speculative investment, and also where are the gains being reaped now.
And again, just from a policy perspective, I think the hope of this zip code data is it may actually identify neighborhoods that are most at risk. And that, given the different, what's happened over the last 10 years, that we may want to, again, focus some of city efforts on to avoid, some of the displacement issues, some of the other issues that we've talked about earlier today.
So let's get to the bottom line in terms of where the city is. Essentially, again, these are the good times. What we tend to see in both good times, both in good times and in bad, is all the sort of ancillary impacts tend to all fall in support of whichever direction we're going, and that's what we're seeing now. We're making URA changes that are yielding more property tax revenues at a time where property tax revenue growth is highest anyway. So things just have tended to head that direction. The overall growth is typical of our highest level seen during economic expansions. I think this is a really important point that Andrew and I will drill, I'm sure, over the next 20 minutes or so, that this is the opportunity. This is the opportunity to make long-term investments, to create capital set-asides, those kinds of things. So because the reality is we do expect slower growth in the out years, economic slowdown becomes more likely. I'll talk a little bit about that and those dynamics in just a minute. And also, in terms of property taxes, as we move to the next slide, the reality is that I think what the data will show us, the micro-level data will show us, is that compression eased in Southwest Portland in particular. Those are very high-valued properties relative to the rest of the city, generally very high-valued properties that fell into compression during the last several years. And the value changes come back, meaning that some of those properties will see significantly greater than 3% increases in property taxes. And so what you see on the graph here is that we're really, even if you factor out the URA changes, which are worth about 1 percentage point here, property taxes are growing at record rates for the current year. And again, this is one of those things where everything sort of falls all in the same direction. We've got the URA changes, we've got compression and unwinding in Southwest, we've got a bunch of new construction all over the city that's coming online. And so all these are feeding into higher property tax collections in the near term.
Just in case anybody is listening, your Parks bond vote will not change your property tax rate.
And just to echo that point, this is only general fund property taxes. And individual experience may vary.
Josh, I just also have to add that I live in Southwest, and occasionally I go to a New Seasons in Beaverton. And when I come back across the county line, it feels so much more compressed every time.
It likely is. And so as we move, just looking at our other one other large revenue component, business license tax receipts. This is very noisy data, so I don't want to draw too many conclusions to it. But you might recall this time last year, we were getting a little worried about business license tax data, and you can see why on the graph. Basically, over the turn of the year, basically late last year into early this year, it looked really weak. It wasn't. By the time we got to the end of the year, we're seeing massive growth. We're still trying to unwind some of that data. We don't have all of it in yet. Early indications are, is the reality that this is a tax that is disproportionately paid by a small number of taxpayers. So to the extent that 50 or 100 taxpayers that may have some things in common, but not a ton, all tend to have good years at the same time, we can see a bump, and there's not a lot of modeling that can do to get us there. So that's why we tend to be a little bit more conservative with this forecast than we might be with others. As we look to just a preliminary forecast, this initial forecast, this is a general thinking that I'll probably be talking about hopefully for a long time. But the reality is that we're assuming sort of above average revenue growth for this year, next, and about average growth maybe in 16, 17, with a little bit below average growth thereafter. What this means is that there will be in the neighborhood of $5 million of ongoing. Don't get married to that number. There's a variety of things that will impact that. The reality is, though, is that it's very modest. It's 1% of revenues. It's a half of a percent of revenues and expenses. There's lots of things that go into that number. But the reality is that there's not going to be a lot of ongoing because of the way we balance our forecast over the five-year forecast horizon. By looking out 5 years and having slower revenue growth in years 4 and 5, we know we can't afford more than this ongoing expenses in the near term in order to fund it all the way through the forecast horizon. Again, this is primarily due to the surge in property taxes. Property taxes are much less sensitive to economic changes. They tend to be more base building than, say, business license taxes that go up and down. Property taxes tend to never fall or even be flat, even with a library district. So what this also does, though, because we are at the cyclical high, I would expect to have some very significant one-time money available. So right now, probably in excess of $10 million. And that will probably persist for a year or two, I would expect. Just some context, I think, generally speaking, this is the time last cycle where we created large amounts of unfunded ongoing or serial one-time or however, I forget exactly the term we used when I got here. But the reality is that there's an opportunity here to invest. We've talked a lot about capital. And so to invest in things rather than programs and people. We've got a backlog. We've got issues on that end. This is the opportunity to create some of those things. As we look to what the major risks are, again, $5 million of ongoing, give or take. Half of that can be eaten up through the SAFER grant expiration to fund the firefighters that are currently being funded with the grant. Yes?
I want to ask you about this invest in things, not programs or people, because I think that probably overstates it a little bit. So
okay.
if we invest in a more resilient emergency system, we're investing in things. We're building a place where you get a fuel station or other thing, but the benefit accrues to people.
Sure.
If we put $1 million in the HIF, it is going to build an apartment, presumably, but that's investing in people and programs. So I think I get what you're going, which goes back to when you were saying long-term investments, capital investments, maintaining what we have. But I'm not sure they're mutually exclusive.
No, Can I
comment on that?
Yeah, sure.
I think what is intended is don't do what we said before, what it says up here. In terms of having one-time things that are going to be cyclical one-time things. So in terms of programs and people within the city, but investing in things which could be programs outside of the city, like the rental assistance, but it's a one-time, not an ongoing.
And so the best example is when I got elected, we had a shadow budget we were funding homeless services through the shadow budget with serial one-time. Now, there's nothing nefarious about that, but it was the available resource. So they took one-time. Now, thankfully, we've converted almost all those dollars to ongoing, but the lesson is when the economy collapsed, then we found that we were funding a vital service with a revenue source that was no longer available, and it required us to make cuts in order to get the ongoing to put it on stable footing. So that's the cautionary tale, I take it.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I would say that this is not to say there may be ongoing programs that council wants to expand or add. And I think the fiscal discipline that's needed is again, separating out that you may have one-time resources that are available and you may have limited ongoing. And to the extent you want to add ongoing, we really should be looking at offsets, right? Those ongoing offsets. So even if you've got $5, $10, $15 million of one-time not falling, into the into what we did before of saying, well, for this year, we'll use this one time and we'll figure out something in the future, because as Josh said, notes, the future is likely to have a recession. And it would be much better to sort of make those ongoing decisions separately. And then again, investing in things that help people, which I think, I hope everything we invest in does in fact help people. I mean, I think that's the goal. So
Yeah, so, I absolutely agree with you, Commissioner Fish.
I want to also comment that there's another short-term obligation, which is the expiring parks levy, which is about, that's the one thing that, I, as far as I'm aware, certainly in my bureaus, that were one-time funded that we didn't put into the ongoing funding. So there's about 400,000 of levy-funded positions and programs that are not currently anywhere. So that's a short-term risk. Secondly, in terms of large fiscal obligations, I would just put facilities rather than the Portland building. We don't disvalue our employees who work in awful conditions elsewhere in the community other than the Portland building. So as we're discussing fixes for the Portland building, where some of my park staff work, for example, I'm going to need to have the ongoing discussion about what other facilities do we have employees working in citywide, including in East Portland, please write that down, so that we are equitable and not just looking at the biggest problem, but sometimes there are, I have employees in parks who work in worse facilities than my parks facilities on the 13th floor.
Absolutely. I mean, this is not to be an all-inclusive list. And I think when we look at some of these things, though, they will require some ongoing obligations. Long-term, there's lots of long-term risks. The reality, though, is if we flip to the next slide, it's just sort of a look at sort of when the next recession will hit, right? We're always talking about when's the next one. So the average post-World War II economic expansion is about 5.25 years. I don't think that's a great measure. The reality is the last three have been about 8 years. We've got some reasons that may or may not be why that's the case. But the current expansion is about at that 5.25 year level. June of 2009. It hasn't felt like it's been that long. And after financial crises, they often are slower and longer with some hiccups in between. And so I think the reality is that in all likelihood, we will experience a recession in the five-year forecast horizon. I want to be clear, though, that when we talk about a recession, we're not talking about the last recession. It's the reality is we're not leveraged the same way. We don't have the same interconnectedness. We have some of it, but we're not as susceptible to some of those changes that drove the last one. I think you're much more likely to see a type of recession we saw in the late 90s, early 2000s, or in the early 1990s, which is not insignificant and will drive ongoing cuts, but it's not the severity of the one we just saw. So that's sort of where we're at, I think. And I should say the current forecast, if we were not to have a recession, we would get to 11 years. So in terms of expansion. So I think we need to, while making the budget for next year, we need to be thinking also about the not terribly long-term possibility. Real quick, the next steps. You all will make bump decisions, budget monitoring process decisions next week that will influence these numbers that I've given you. Not dramatically, probably, but they will influence them. Through the next several weeks, we'll finalize our inflation factors, including our cost of living projections, which impact pretty significantly the expense side of the forecast. We also have quarterly payments for utility license fees and lodging taxes in November, middle of the month. And then we're targeting a forecast release the week of December 15th through the 19th. I would expect that we would come around and brief each of you in advance of full release, but we will. That's the next plan. And if there are any questions, I'll turn it over to Andrew.
Questions for Josh on where we are? Okay. I'm just going to spend a few minutes then and run through sort of budget guidance and budget development goals. And in your binder behind this slide presentation is the mayor's budget guidance, which came out on October 15th. So I'm just going to touch on some of the highlights of that. And in general, again, it echoes what Josh is saying here in terms of where we are. I mean, the city's in a very stable position. Things are definitely looking brighter. The Portland economy has been a key economic driver for the state. But again, given some of that caution about where we might be headed, I think one of the key issues here is making sure that the investments we make are prudent investments and that they're responsible investments. And specifically, the mayor asked bureaus to focus, and again, I should say the overall theme again this year is going to be stabilization budget. What that means is that we're not asking bureaus for cuts, but we are also asking for very limited ad package requests and making sure that those ad packages that are enacted are very strategic and very focused on a few things. And again, in terms of what they're focused on, the themes the mayor laid out here were programs that directly impact the lives of citizens, investments that preserve the existing infrastructure that take care of what we have, and finally, things that maintain our place as a leader in innovative urban policy.
Andrew?
Yeah.
Limited ad packages, depending on the year, could mean $30 or $40 million. So is it your sense that the way to create some discipline in that process is to require a commissioner sign off on all ad packages, or is there some other mechanism so that we don't just get back to putting in the whole Christmas tree?
Yeah, so two things there. Yes, it is your role in this over your bureaus is essential in terms of nothing will come forward from them in terms of requests that hasn't been approved by the commissioner in charge going into the process. So that's essential. I think the other piece of this that was included in the budget guidance is that bureaus that are putting forward ad packages, again, with these focus areas in mind, and I'll get to some of the priority areas that the mayor laid out as well. But they're going to be asked to propose options on how to offset that ad with a reduction within their own bureau. And the idea here is not to say that's the reduction that will be taken. The idea is to put options on the table for council. So if you have $1 million ad as a bureau that you want to put on the table for, this is only ongoing. We're not talking about the one-time request, but for ongoing requests, that you also say, if I had to offset that in my bureau, this is the program I would offset it. Now, presumably, that you know, you've already said that the program you would offset with is a higher priority, because if it was a lower priority, you could do that as a bureau director and a commissioner in charge internally. You could do that realignment or propose that realignment to council. But the idea here is that we still need to do the citywide comparison. What's your offset compared to what's an offset in another bureau, compared to what's the opportunity cost of using new resources, if there are new resources on the table, versus not doing the program at all, and really wanting to provide counsel as you go through that decision-making process, that full complement. So you can say, yes, we're going to add it with new money, we're going to add it with an offset somewhere else, or we're going to add it with an offset in your bureau, or we actually don't think this is a high enough priority to add this year at all. So hopefully that also there's going to be some constraint there, because for every $1 million or $2 million that you add, you also need to identify those offsets internally. That's only for the ongoing requests. Again, I think we want to keep one time in a separate process because you're talking about some very large capital dollars, and I don't think there's a lot of value in asking bureaus necessarily to offset that. And so again, the one-time ad requests don't need to have that same offset, but again, focusing those on things that we already have and preserving that existing infrastructure.
Let me just clarify that, what you just said. Mm-hmm. My understanding is that Commissioner Saltzman needs to propose $2.6 million offset somewhere in the Fire Bureau for his ask. I need to propose $400,000 in the Parks budget for my ask. Is that correct?
Correct, yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah. And then some of the other themes in this budget guidance, again, under stabilization budget, is...
Follow sure. that along, since you said we're going to be looking at other bureaus. So is Commissioner Novick precluded from suggesting an offset in the police bureau? I'm being flip, but I mean, does it have to be his bureau, or can it be suggested out of another bureau?
So I would say from a bureau requested budget standpoint, they'll be identifying offsets within their own bureau, because I think that's, again, what sort of they have control over. I think the conversation at the council level, though, it's really going to be up to you in terms of how broadly you want to look at offsetting programs in one bureau with offsets in another. But I think we talked about this internally, and I don't think it's a good idea to have bureaus pointing at other bureaus and saying, well, I'll take their offset. But I think it's absolutely the conversation council should have.
But well, most bureaus are not required to propose an offset if they're not asking for any new money. Then they're
right.
not proposed to ask cuts. But this might be an opportunity for us as the council. Historically, the budget is based on the previous year's budget for that bureau, and it's cuts plus or minus, and some of which we take, some of which we don't. Mm-hmm. At this point, since there's a relatively small number of bureaus that are going to have to propose cuts, that we should have that conversation about, are there other places that we want to ask other bureaus to do some balancing?
It also strikes me that we're not using the 95-5 split this year. And one of the benefits when we had that last time was every bureau had to in effect, offer up the 5%. Mm-hmm. And then that was before the council. So in the absence of a 95-5 split, what is the mechanism for us to identify potential offsets in other bureaus?
So again, to the extent a bureau asks for something, that offset will be on the table. To the extent council wants to dig into a specific area, I think that's a conversation that can be had now. It can be had during the work sessions later. Although again, to the extent we get late in the budget process, it's obviously difficult to do that. So I think if there are specific areas where the council may want to look at that, it's a conversation for the council to have. Again, some of the themes I think running through this budget guidance, again, really the idea of a stabilization budget is asking bureaus to focus on accomplishing their primary goals with their existing resources, asking them again to realign resources to their core mission and council priorities. So really spending time saying, you know, is what I'm currently doing, are the programs I'm currently doing aligned with where I as a bureau director want to go and with where council, my commissioner in charge or council want me to go, and really focusing at those things. And then continuing to search for efficiencies to reinvest those savings in services. I think that's always something that every year I hope bureaus are doing to sort of find those efficiencies. And to the extent they can identify them internally, they can fund their own expansions or add packages. And also the Innovation Fund, there's a portion of that that's being made available this year for business process improvements that might create ongoing savings. And again, sort of looking at those issues as well. And then in terms of the overall themes, ongoing resources, again, the mayor's laid out some similar themes to last year with a little bit of a change in terms of a little broader focus on equity and opportunity, and that includes some of the housing and homelessness issues last year, but again, a little bit broader look at equity. And along those lines, CBO's working with the Office of Equity right now to develop what those impact measures could be and what some key performance indicators would be. So again, bureaus have a sense of when we're talking about what that focus on equity is, what is the needle that we're trying to move, and how will we know that we've made progress there? And again, complete neighborhoods and emergency preparedness as well. And then the one-time resources focused on existing infrastructure and then expanding infrastructure in underserved areas of the city. There's a slide in here on performance focus, but I think I've talked about that earlier. So again, I'll sort of skip over that in the interest of time, but really hoping to, again, continue that performance focus. And then some of the key dates. Again, November 20th, we're having a budget kickoff. That's a Bureau staff kickoff where we go through a lot of just the technical issues around the budget process. You're welcome to send some of your staff if you want, but again, that's more focused on bureaus. December 17th, or that week, the five-year financial forecast will be released. February 3rd is the date when requested budgets from bureaus will be due to CBO. And then again, February and March, budget work sessions, and then we pick up with the mayor's proposed and council-approved processes at that point. Any questions overall on process?
You want to get close to our original schedule, take a 5-minute break, and come back and dive into the bump? Does that work?
Great. Yeah, thanks.